It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at what's happening in Congress. The clock is ticking, and we've got less than 30 days of legislating before the fall elections.
First, some news out of western Wisconsin. Last night, the Eau Claire City Council voted 9-1 to ban the use of electronic cigarettes or e-cigarettes in city buildings.
The decision comes after the Eau Claire County Board voted to ban e-cigarettes in county buildings in May. And this all comes as the Food and Drug Administration considers e-cig regulations, but so far, nothing has been set in stone yet.
Here to talk with us about these recent decisions on e-cigarettes and what this could mean for the state going forward is Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, as we said, the Eau Claire City Council voted almost unanimously to ban e-cigarettes in public buildings. Why did they make that move?
Well, partially because there's not a lot known about these products and about the possible health impacts they might be having on not only the people using them, but people around them. It was a 9-1 in favor of passing the ordinance decision. And basically the woman, Kathy Mitchell, city council member, told me that she just, until more is known, she doesn't feel comfortable not doing anything. You know, if they wait too long and it turns out it is a danger, then they'll have... They'll have waited too long.
And a lot of people sharing that opinion on the city council. Where exactly would the ban apply?
This is it's a little different than some of the other bans that we've seen in other municipalities around the state. This would only apply to city-owned buildings, say your library, you know, your city government building, city-owned buses. There's an ice arena here owned by the city, those places.
So there's a large number of other places where e-cigarettes are still allowed, but as far as city buildings go, e-cigs are out.
E-cigs are out at city buildings. You can still bring them into the bars. That's where this ordinance that was passed last night in Eau Claire is a little different than what happened in Onalaska and Eshwabanon, the other two city and village where it was passed. Those, it's more inclusive. It's basically kind of working the e-cig ban into the existing smoking ban at bars and pretty much all enclosed spaces where the public gathers.
Well, not everyone agrees with this move, including that one city council member who voted against it. What are critics saying?
Well, the critics are saying that, well, pretty much the same reasoning. We don't know much about it, and for all we know, we're going too far too fast and kind of wait and see, I guess.
Now, Rich, you live in Eau Claire. Do you see a lot of people out and about smoking e-cigarettes?
You know, it's funny. I don't see people smoking the e-cigarettes very often, but the number of stores that I've seen selling them and what are called vape bars, where I guess you get together and you know, smoke these things, I've seen them springing up quite a bit in little strip malls here and there. It's definitely, it seems like it's a trend. But as far as individuals, I haven't seen a whole lot.
Now, in 2008, Eau Claire was one of the communities in Wisconsin that passed a citywide indoor smoking ban. That was before the whole state went forward with that statewide ban. Do you think there's a similar case to be made here, that that's how it will unfold this time around?
Well, Eau Claire seems to be pretty progressive in what it passes, but I'm not sure if we're going to see a statewide e-cig ban right out of the box, because we've got one state senator, Glenn Grothman. He's from southeastern Wisconsin, and he last session introduced a bill that would exempt e-cigarettes from the statewide smoking ban. The bill died; it didn't really go anywhere. But he says he will introduce it again.
Now, e-cigarettes, you know, have been rising in popularity. I've seen people smoking e-cigarettes in airports and other places where, you know, it would be shocking these days to see someone smoking the usual kind of cigarette. Do you think that's part of what's going on here, a cultural response to e-cigarettes?
I asked about that. I asked this Kathy Mitchell about it, and she says that is probably playing a part. You know, it's about kind of respecting other people's personal space, I guess. And I asked her if part of this is just the shock of, you know, we've been years into a smoking ban where you're not going to see someone just light up right next to you in certain places. And if you see someone put this contraption in their mouth and start blowing what looks like smoke out, I asked her if that's part of it, but she said yes, but the main part is the unknowns about public health.
And I suppose when you've got people who look like they're smoking cigarettes to kids, that could also be confusing. But again, not probably part of the considerations.
No. And, you know, the considerations, they basically looked at Eau Claire County had passed a similar ban, almost identical, really, county-owned buildings in that case. They passed that in June. And so the city council had been looking at it, and they felt like they had the standing to go ahead with it once they saw the county do it, and then also they saw Onalaska and Ashwaubenon go for it too. So I talked with someone with the American Lung Association in Wisconsin, and they seem to think that this is going to be part of a big trend. Like, the ball is rolling, she said. So we'll have to wait and see.
Well, you mentioned there were four other communities that had different types of e-cigarette bans, and Eau Claire, though, is the biggest of these.
Mm-hmm.
How significant is that when you look at Wisconsin as a whole?
It's significant. It's significant. You know, we've got about 70,000 people here, give or take. So that makes a statement. But again, Eau Claire does seem to pass some things, a lot of ordinances. Not long ago, they passed a resolution stating that they think the state should raise the tax on beer. Well, that's not going to make any changes, but it definitely sends a message when you've got a city of this size, you know, making that call.
As you've been out and about in Eau Claire, what are people saying about this ban in city buildings?
Well, I have not gotten out and about. This was passed last night.
Soon.
It's not even in action yet. It'll probably be in place and in effect within the next week or two, depending when it's printed in the paper. But so I have not gotten any reaction other than from folks in the office here. And again, it's along the lines of, well, we don't really know much about them. So maybe it's just too soon to say whether these things are healthy or not. So maybe a ban isn't such a bad idea.
So the city council coming down on the side of caution.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
That was WPR's reporter in Eau Claire, Rich Kramer. He joined us to talk about the city's ban on e-cigarettes in city buildings. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's time for our weekly look at the inside workings of Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
Lawmakers are back from their July 4th recess, and that means they have less than 30 days of legislation time before the November elections. On the docket are highway funding and reform of the VA, but will they have time to get any of it done?
And after last week's Hobby Lobby ruling, Democrats in the Senate have unveiled legislation today that would override the Supreme Court's decision to exempt closely held corporations from part of the Affordable Care Act. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice talking to you.
Well, let's start with this Hobby Lobby ruling and what congressional Democrats are up to. I just had a chance to skim that news article, so I don't know too much about it. What's the legislation look like, and how do you override the Supreme Court?
Well, overriding the Supreme Court is not necessarily challenging, because the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case was interpreting laws that had already been passed regarding, you know, where Congress had said that corporations and individuals should have protection for their religious beliefs. So there's no theoretical problem with Congress passing a law that says, sorry, we were not meaning to protect your religious beliefs in this matter, which is to say, corporations, you have to actually provide health care coverage to people even when it offends your religious views, which is basically what the Hobby Lobby case is about. So, in theory, Congress could do this, and that's essentially what the bill that the Democrats are trying to push now is to go ahead and write into law that corporations have to provide health insurance, particularly for things like contraception, most notably the morning after pill, even if they have religious objections to it. Their workers essentially would have a right to have it anyhow. But that's all kind of philosophy. It's not going to pass, because the House of Representatives would never take it up to begin with. And even in the Senate, there's a lot of moderate Democrats running for re-election who want no part of this. They don't want to have to vote, essentially, as the opponents would put it, against religious freedom.
So this is just more symbolic than anything else?
Yes.
So any chance you, I mean, and I understand that there's lots between here and there, but any chance that this is an issue, let's say it doesn't succeed this time around, do you think it's got the kind of legs, the kind of gravitas where we might see it again in a year or two?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think there's a whole bunch more opportunities for people to make these cases. Congress will continue to peck at this issue. These are the sort of things that over years we evolve. Literally, we evolve, meaning that the nation's views sort of weave back and forth on these topics. So who knows what bill is possible sometime in the future. I just am not counting on it between now and January.
On a related note regarding Obamacare, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin has filed a lawsuit regarding that and his staff and what he regards as preferential treatment for congressional staffers and so forth. He's had his day in court now. What's the sense in Washington that this is this something that people are watching, or is this something that people are like, well, here's one senator out there kind of by himself?
This is a topic that is of great enthusiasm in some very small quarters, particularly the Republican Party. And I'm going to try to avoid getting technical here, but basically Congress eliminated all of the staff health care benefits in the Affordable Care Act, because these Republicans are saying they should not be getting preferential treatment. They should be treated the same way as everybody else. The problem is everybody else still has employer-provided health care. The only people who don't have employer-provided health care now are basically Congress and their staff. So the Obama administration said, well, okay, we can fix that. We'll just provide it as a stipend. And that is what the senator is objecting to. He's saying that by doing that, they're providing preferential treatment to him and his staff. And it's kind of an odd thing. Then the government is now saying, well, we don't understand how we've done you any harm. How can you sue? And he says, well, I'm suing because you make me look bad. You make it look like I'm taking preferential treatment. Who knows? I think it's wacky, honestly, because it's a very odd sort of technical point, and he's going to have a hard time making the case. But if he wins, he will have won the right to not have his staff have health care.
Interesting. And he, as I say, he's had his day in court, and so we will hear what the results of that will be. But do you expect that, you know, as Obamacare continues to roll out and unfold, are there going to be more, I don't know if I want to call them unintended consequences, but more technical things like this that are going to be bubbling up to the surface that people are either going to attack or try to fix? Is this ever going to end?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's a big law. It affects a lot of people. There will be, I mean, you know, I don't know if you remember some years ago they had to fix the Medicare donut hole, right? Mm-hmm. It so happens that they hadn't anticipated a certain growth in need of prescription for certain senior citizens. You know, these are things that we just sort of don't know until over time we start to apply the law and we discover them. So this is something, yeah, I suspect you'll see dozens of these things over the years as people try to figure out, as this law becomes implemented and millions of people join, we're going to find a whole bunch of little things, technical things particularly, that need to be repaired.
Turning back to the current session of Congress and what we can look forward to before the election, I note that there is some discussion now about, obviously it's going to be a lame duck Congress. We've got the elections coming up, that chance that the Senate could flip from Democrat to Republican. And the question is, do we do stuff now or we do stuff later? Is that something that is getting a lot of attention right now?
Well, there's a couple of things that Congress pretty much needs to do. One is the Highway Trust Fund is going to expire, run out of money sometime this summer. Congress needs to do something to allow us to continue to pay to pave roads. It's not clear what they're going to do. There's some proposals in the Senate. There's proposals in the House. It's hard to figure out how to pay for these things. But those become sort of a top-line issue that they want to get done. Remember, there's also a lot of enthusiasm to pass some sort of legislation to fix problems in the Veterans Administration and the way they've been basically delaying health care to veterans. The House and Senate have both passed bills, but they're not the same bill. They have to come up with an agreement, and that, again, something they want to get done in the next couple of weeks. Other than that, you know, President Obama's asking for a lot of money for an immigration border fix. I don't know if he's going to get that anytime soon, but that would be something that's probably high on the list of Democrats to try and get done. But, you know, there's just not a lot of enthusiasm for passing legislation. And keep in mind that for the Republicans, what you said makes the most critical point here is if they think they're going to win the Senate, they're not going to get a better deal with a bill they pass now if they can pass a similar bill in January with more Republicans. So why should they compromise now?
Absolutely. Wait and see what happens. And if they come out on top, life is going to get a lot better for them, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So
unless it has to actually get done, I would not expect it getting done.
Right. So another question, another thing we didn't bring up, spending bills are out there, too. Some of those are working their way through this sort of tortuous process. We're not going to see a budget on October 1st, are we?
I doubt it. They're not going to shut down the government.
And
I think
we're
pretty much past that. It would not surprise me in the least for them to pass a three-month extension that gets us to January and then allows the new Congress to fight this battle. And again, for the Republicans, if you want to cut more spending or lower more taxes, whatever you're going to do, you're better off waiting till January and putting off a fight.
So is Congress doing itself any favors right now in terms of its popularity, of its polls, of its perception among the American public that not a whole lot's getting done?
No. But, you know, I think to some degree I begin to believe that we stop thinking of the Congress as an institution at this point, and we start thinking about it as two political campaigns, one being run by the Democrats, one being run by the Republicans. And it's just not an institution at this moment. There are not a lot of people who stand up and say, I am here fighting for the Congress. It is now an issue of trying to make your agenda, make your points, and win an election in November.
Kind of on a related note to that, you wrote an article this week about the costs of investigating the terrorist attack in Benghazi back in 2012. Is that indicative of what you're just talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, what we found out is that they're going to spend $3 million this year on that new Benghazi investigative subcommittee, which does not include, keep in mind, four other committees that have concluded investigations of the same affair. And it also only runs, that's the May through December total. This committee is going to likely run beyond December into next year. It's going to require another chunk of money. And at that rate, that's $5 million a year spending rate to investigate the Benghazi attacks. That's a lot of money. That's more money than the House Veterans Affairs Committee spends every year. So if they actually spend that much money, it'll be a very significant cost for an investigation. Democrats believe that the investigation exists only to embarrass Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Republicans believe it exists to uncover what they think were misdeeds by the administration and misinformation provided by the administration.
So a lot of what the future of this particular committee, though, could look like, would that ride on what happens in the fall elections then?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, honestly, the House of Representatives is going to remain Republican-controlled, and the Republican-controlled House is going to continue this committee. I think all of that is not going to change no matter what, because the Republicans, like I said, will still continue to control the House of Representatives. I think part of the question becomes, does the Senate take up any of this cudgel? And that will depend a lot on what happens in November. If there's a lot more Republican senators, they may very well join this drumbeat that the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton acted improperly in this matter.
So as you take a look at some of the congressional races around the country right now shaping up, what are the key ones that if we are interested in the fate of the Senate in the next in November that we should be keeping an eye on?
Well, you know, there's a half dozen. The one that I think, or the two that are most watchable are Mark Pryor, Democratic senator in Arkansas, and Mary Landrieu, a Democratic senator in Louisiana, both considered very vulnerable, both have fought their way through re-election a couple of times before, and both face fairly significant, really well-funded challengers with a lot of national money. Those are going to be very, very loud, very, very bruising campaigns. If those two lose their re-election bids, Democrats are in significant trouble in the Senate.
And right now, both Republicans and Democrats are talking tough, but time will tell, won't it?
Who knows what can happen between now and November that changes the landscape. But at the moment, the Republicans look like they have an upper hand. A lot of money yet to be spent and a lot of votes yet to be cast.
Well, Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's great talking to you, Gene.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to help us break down what's really happening in Congress.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up later on in the program, we'll learn more about what makes electric fish and eels electric.
If you bought a pack of cigarettes or a case of beer in the last few decades, you've probably noticed a warning on the package, courtesy of the United States Surgeon General. But how much do you really know about the so-called nation's doctor?
Our next guest has written a book that takes a look at the history of the office and its role in American society. And while we'd like to think that the Surgeon General is the leading authority on public health in this country, our guest says that that office doesn't hold as much power as it used to. And in an era of declining budgets and other high-profile health figures, it may no longer make sense for the country to keep the position.
Joining us now is Mike Stobie. He's the national medical correspondent for the Associated Press, and his new book is called Surgeon General's Warning: How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So it seems as though the role of Surgeon General is open to interpretation to a certain extent, maybe more so in the past, but what exactly is the Surgeon General charged with doing?
Well, these days, the Surgeon General is mainly a health educator, a spokesman on public health issues on behalf of the government. There was a time when the Surgeon General was the most powerful person in the federal public health structure. I mean, this is the person who oversaw the CDC, who oversaw the NIH. Those are powers that were taken away decades ago. Now he or she is a spokesman.
You start off your book with Regina Benjamin, a recent Surgeon General, who pretty much embodies the idea that Surgeon Generals have little impact anymore. How did her term play out?
She was interesting. She was this figure who had founded a clinic that served the poor in a small town in Alabama, and she'd gotten some national press for doing these wonderful efforts and keeping her clinic open even after hurricanes and fire destroyed it. But she turned out to be a very quiet presence with very low visibility. I cover public health. I cover the CDC and national public health issues for the AP. By the way, I'm one of several medical correspondents. I'm not the only one. But the people on my beat, I talked to them about my project as I was working on it, this book, and I found many of them couldn't even name her. They didn't know the identity of the current Surgeon General while she was in office, and that was striking to me. She resigned last year. She still had several months left on her term, but she kind of quietly faded away.
You portray her in the book as someone who was just kind of happy to be there, who didn't want to make a lot of waves. She didn't even have the Twitter handle Surgeon General because that was taken. She was forced to take this obscure one instead, sort of indicative of the fact that, you know, there was not a lot of power behind her position at that point, and she was not a person who came wanting to, seemingly, to have a voice.
Yeah, that's right. She didn't have any great ambition. She's a very nice person, by the way, and was gracious enough to let me come visit her, you know, in her first official days in the office. I got to watch her confirmation ceremony. But, yeah, from the beginning, she was candid that she didn't have a burning issue she wanted to work on. And it was clear from tracing the history of other Surgeons General that some of the ones that had the most visibility and perhaps the most impact were people who kind of had a fire in their belly about something. C. Everett Koop on smoking. He was a relentless crusader against smoking, you know, shaking his finger at the tobacco industry. And Joycelyn Elders, many people remember Dr. Elders from the early 1990s, crusading on teenage pregnancy. And Dr. Benjamin, just really didn't have anything in particular that she wanted to work on. She said she'd be happy to do anything that the administration assigned her. And my reporting found that they didn't assign her much.
You mentioned some of the past surgeons general who did have a lot of influence in their role. When they had that high profile, what kind of relationship did surgeons general have with Americans?
I'm sorry, with Americans?
With Americans, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it helps to be visible and known. I think there's an interest by the public to have, I'm searching for a better term, but a stand-up guy who, you know, is in the federal public health system, somebody who, you know, they can trust. We all know that there's politics going on in Washington, and that there may be times when, even when the science suggests that, for example, needle exchange programs are a good way to combat AIDS and HIV, or the promotion of certain types of sex education is maybe a better strategy than abstinence-only programs. There are politics that for different reasons may cause an administration, an HHS secretary, even a CDC director to kind of shrink away from putting out some of those controversial messages. So I think there's a thirst by at least some Americans for somebody out there who could speak truth to power, to use the jargon, and say what the science is, to be an adjudicator of science, and you know, who will tell the truth beyond political considerations or implications. And the Surgeon General at time has been that quasi-independent force. Coop worked under Reagan, but he said things that were not consistent with the Reagan administration. David Satcher worked under Clinton and George W. Bush. He put out reports that contradicted some of the messaging of the of those administrations. So that's happened in our history, and people, especially older people who remember Satcher, Coop, elders, people 40 and older, I think remember that and look for those days to come again.
And will they? Is it possible that the powers of the Surgeon General will increase once more?
You know, anything's possible. I came to the conclusion, you know, I worked on this book for about 7 years, and for much of that time, I was thinking, you know, this is a job with terrific potential, and we just have to figure out a way to put in safeguards and bring these stand-up guys and stand-up women back into a position where they're not facing political meddling and they can perform this service. But, you know, gradually, I just from watching different people hold the office, I kind of changed my mind and reluctantly and sadly came to the conclusion that it's just not going to happen. Inside the Beltline, most of the power brokers, I came to believe, don't have a real interest in having a quasi-independent Surgeon General. Presidential administrations do not want the headache of somebody who's off message. People in Congress, most notably, but not exclusively, social conservatives are not interested in safeguarding a position who may go off and talk about gun violence and gun control, or may go off and talk about condom distribution. People don't want to spend their political capital on that position. They have their own things to deal with. And as I was suggesting earlier, I guess, if you're younger than 40, maybe you don't even know much about a Surgeon General. You don't remember Coop. And it doesn't mean anything to you. So I don't think it's a fight that's going to happen. I don't think anyone's going to take up arms in favor of the Surgeon General. And So what do we have? We have a situation where this is just going to kind of drag out, and we spend, it's not a lot of money. I mean, the Surgeon General's salary is around $200,000, and the office is small. It's not a ton of money that's spent on this, but, you know, we're seeing thousands and thousands and thousands of job reductions in local health departments across the country these last several years. And, you know, $200,000 will get you maybe an epidemiologist or two, or, you know, some other
spending the money somewhere
positions.
Else.
Yeah, you could spend it somewhere else. So do we let this drag out, or, you know, do we move on and just say, sadly, that time is over?
Well, let's look at the roots of this position. How did the role of Surgeon General first come into being? What was the purpose of it?
Well, it was the first Surgeon General went into office in 1871, and it was a different job then. There was this thing called the Marine Hospital Service that was created way at the beginning of the country, and it was actually a network of federal hospitals for sailors. It had its origins back in England, you know, after the English Navy defeated the Spanish Armada, and a grateful England said, we need to do something for the sailors. We need to have some way of providing care for them, you know, because they saved our nation. And that tradition was carried on to the colonies. And so we had federal marine hospitals, a little string of hospitals spread throughout the country, which took care of sailors. But it gradually became a mess. I mean, the hospitals were largely under local control, and there was cronyism, and the hospitals fell into disrepair. And there were several federal reviews of this through the years, and each time said, you know, we need to clean up the system. Finally, there was a set of reforms passed, and they said, we're going to create a new head position for this. We're going to call them the supervising surgeon of the Marine Hospital System. Well, the supervising surgeon this was a period where the nation was dealing with a lot of epidemics, cholera, yellow fever, and the emerging public health system in our nation was kind of struggling on the best way to control epidemics and who would lead it, and, you know, are states the best ones to institute quarantines, and all this stuff was going on. And the early surgeons general, the early supervising surgeons of the Marine Hospital Service laid claim to that function, quarantine control and disease control, because their hospitals were in the ports. A lot of these diseases came in through ports, and, you know, there were some political fights back then, but they ended up winning, and they became the head of the federal system. They were in charge of quarantines, and they became very powerful, and as new agencies came on board, as the CDC was created, as the NIH was created, these things fell under the position that later became known as the Surgeon General in charge of the U.S. Public Health Service.
So pretty different beginning there. We're talking now with Mike Stobie about the history and role of the Surgeon General in the United States, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what the Surgeon General does or maybe should be doing? Do you remember the work of C. Everett Koop or Luther Terry on subjects like AIDS or smoking? Did it have an impact on you? And do you think it still makes sense to have a Surgeon General in the United States? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a moment, but right now here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst of the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to Mike Stobie, author of Surgeon General's Warning about the History and Role of the Office in the United States.
And you can join in the discussion, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Surgeon General, the Office of Surgeon General, and what that office, what that person should be doing? Do you have memories of Surgeon General's past that really stuck with you, that really accomplished something? And do you think it still makes sense to have that office? 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
And we were talking earlier about C. Everett Koop, one of the more memorable surgeons general of recent years. He's one that I remember as well, Mike. He was someone who stuck in your mind as you were writing this book. Let's take a listen to the kind of personality that he brought to the role. Here he is talking about his role becoming a spokesperson for education on AIDS.
It became associated with drug abuse, with sexual promiscuity, and with IV drug paraphernalia, and a huge number of the conservatives in this country said they deserve what they got, just ignore them and let them die. Well, you can't be a doctor and do that, mm-hmm. You can't be the Surgeon General and do that. Mm-hmm. I'm the Surgeon General of the moral and the immoral, the males and the females, you treat them as you would any patient that comes to you for help.
A bit there from C. Everett Koop, one of the more recent Surgeons General of Influence. We go down to the phone lines. Connor joins us in Cumberland. Hi, Connor.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
It seems to me that the Surgeon General's office does more than, the Surgeon General himself. So wouldn't it make more sense to kind of just eliminate the big, head of the office and kind of minimize it and make, have them kind of do some of the regulatory stuff, but just downsize the Surgeon General's office?
Okay, interesting point. What do you say to that, Mike?
Well, I mean, the Surgeon General's office is already a bare bones operation. I think the staff is 10 people currently or less. They just support, and they're not all of them are assigned to the Surgeon General full time. But Regina Benjamin didn't even have her own speechwriter. That's what she told me. And I think that ship has sailed in terms of, the Surgeon General having more administrative powers. Those were stripped away during the Johnson administration in 1968. The Johnson administration became very dissatisfied with the Surgeon General, especially his troops, the Commission Corps officers in the public health, and didn't feel they were really moving the ball on the things that they wanted to get done in terms of Great Society programs. So, the Surgeon General no longer was overseeing the CDC, no longer overseeing NIH, no longer doing that stuff. So I hope I'm not misunderstanding your point, but I think that's not on the table anymore. I don't think the HHS secretary or the CDC director or the FDA commissioner are going to be ceding any powers to the Surgeon General.
Right. They're not going to want to add duties, responsibilities, oversight to the role of Surgeon General because there's already this tension of power between those agencies and the Surgeon General.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Connor. We're going to go next to Scott joining us from Toma. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I vaguely remember a conversation at the beginning of the Obama administration when he was forming his cabinet, et cetera, that CNN's Sanjay Gupta was being considered for that role. And frankly, I don't remember if he withdrew his name from consideration or that never got very far. But it seemed at the time like, he's one of the better, more widely known medical professionals in the country. Can you tell me a little more about what happened at that time?
Great. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, good question. Your memory is right. Gupta was reportedly the main choice. It was why he acknowledged it, that he had been approached and sat down with the Obama people and was thinking hard about it. He went up to visit Koop and talk about it. And people were excited because, the Surgeon General's job had been sort of lapsing into kind of irrelevant status. And here was this guy. He was a superstar. He's on TV. He's this respected authority. A reporter, a neurosurgeon, and he was somebody that they thought people would listen to, and might give the job visibility it hadn't seen in at least a decade. But he, things got messy. the Surgeon General is one of a whole set of officials, and there was, I don't know if you remember, Tom Daschle was going to be, for the senator from South Dakota, was the initial choice for HHS secretary, and the plan was that, you know, they would be, everyone was going to work on health reform, and, you know, Daschle would lead it, but Gupta would work with Daschle, and Gupta would not only be a Surgeon General, but he'd be a main salesman, a main spokesman on behalf of the administration for the need for health reform, for what became the Affordable Care Act. But then Daschle had to pull out. There was some controversy over, I'm trying to remember what it was, back taxes or something. There was a controversy that raged for, you know, weeks, and it was a headache, and Daschle withdrew. So so some of the cast that Gupta was going to work with was changing. And, you know, Gupta's a fairly young guy, and he draws income from his medical work and from CNN, and he's got a young family, and given everything else that was going on and the change of people he'd be working with, he pulled out. One thing that has affected the Surgeon General job, this is not a high-paying job. I mean, I said it's close to $200,000, but as you recognize, there's people in the medical field who make a lot more than that, and in the past, there have been people who haven't taken the job largely because it didn't pay enough. I don't know that was a main motivation for Gupta, but it was certainly something he considered.
And Mike, in our last minute here, what do you think the American public misses out on, if anything, by not having a strong Surgeon General anymore?
Well, I think sometimes we're adrift as you know, controversies come along. You know, as people start appearing on TV and saying, well, I think vaccines cause autism. And when there's no one, this happened several years ago, and Jenny McCarthy was on Oprah Winfrey, and, you know, Oprah has a huge audience, and she was talking about her experience with her child, and no one went on the show to oppose her. There was no, you know, and some argue that's a game you can't win. You can't go on Oprah with Jenny McCarthy and convince the audience that you're right and they're wrong, but nobody tried. And when we don't have a Surgeon General, someone in the uniform who's instantly esteemed, countering these messages, you know, we've seen the results of that. We've seen vaccination exemptions go up in some states, and we've seen the resurgence of measles and some other vaccine preventable diseases. We're constantly facing e-cigarettes.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Mike. Thank you so much. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Sorry, I went over.
We've been talking to Mike Stovey, national medical correspondent for the Associated Press. His new book is called Surgeon General's Warning.